You're listening to Rosie Cole's Vaudeville Broadcast. This program may contain adult content, so if you're under 18, please either get permission or switch it off. Hello, listeners of the podcast. I have a fantastic guest for you today. I am here in lovely Soho with Glory Pearl.
Good afternoon.
So, Glory, for the listeners, what is it that you do?
What do I do?
What do you do? You do so many things.
I do
you
so have many things.
Multifaceted career.
Yeah,
so
I just can't make my mind up. I don't know. What do I do? I don't know. I'm as poncy as it sounds, I'm kind of heading ever rapidly more towards the idea of calling myself a performance artist, which just sounds super wanky. But yeah, I'm an actor, singer, dancer, ex-pole dancer and trapeze artist, stand-up comedian, cabaret performer, character comedian, done pretty much most of it.
It's so funny, on the cabaret circuit I talk to so many performers who are like, I do all these things, so I don't know if I should pick one, so I'm just going to say, I work.
I do stuff.
As a performer.
Yeah.
I work on the art of performance, therefore I'm a performance artist, but not in the way that you think, like, I'm going to go on
Here's a three-hour piece about my vagina.
Yeah. You haven't always been a performance artist. Have you?
Well, off and on. I mean, so I started quite young as a kid. I did a lot of theatre as a kid. And then it was really what I wanted to do with my life. But I was told, no, you can't do that. You're far too intelligent. You need to go and get a proper job and some proper qualifications.
No!
So I did.
Wrong!
Well, kind of did. I got thrown out of school for not doing any work. And then I came to London. And then I trained as a saddler.
And then a saddler is in someone who makes saddles for horses.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a bit of a diversion.
It is. Well, I mean, I had horses. It was an interesting scene. The day I got thrown out of school, I got called into the head of sixth form's office. And she sat there with an A to Z of careers on her desk. And she said to me, right, we need to go through this and find something for you to do because you can't stay here. So we went through it, and when we got to S, we got to saddler, and I said, oh, that sounds interesting, because I was into horses at the time. And that's what I did, randomly.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an interesting direction to send you off in. I mean, at least you cared enough to go, we've got to set you up before...
Before we kick you out.
Before we send you out into the cold, hard world with nothing. Let's just sort you out a little
bit. That's all right. It was a good thing for me. So, yeah, I kind of went to college and grew up and worked for a couple of years, then went to university, kind of blagged my way in there, amazingly.
Which university?
I went to Queen Mary, University of London. Yeah, and so by that time I was kind of, how old was I, 21? So they had a policy where they would interview every mature student, and at 21 you qualified as a mature student, so they gave me an interview and they offered me a place on an English degree. So
that's fantastic.
It was fantastic. I would say those 3 years changed my life. Absolutely changed my life. The environment that I was exposed to, the ideas that I was exposed to, the people was incredibly inspiring, and they gave me a language with which to express my thoughts and my opinions, and a kind of structure for doing that. And there was a real kind of egalitarian approach there, where you could speak to my professor Lisa Jardine, who was kind of on TV and on Radio 3 all the time, and you could say something in a seminar and she would respond to that as if you were Professor Emeritus at Yale or whatever. She was phenomenal in that respect, so it was very inspiring. And I did my degree, my master's degree, and I really wanted to do a PhD, but I couldn't afford it, so I became a teacher instead. As you do. And did that for a while. And while I was teaching, I wrote quite a few plays and staged plays with the kids, which
great.
Was really good fun. And then when I decided to leave teaching and move into advertising, I took a 40% pay cut and I just bought a house. So I had to find another way to pay my mortgage. So I kind of went back to my roots, and that was when I started performing, initially as a kind of stripper and pole dancer.
So, wow. So yeah, you went grew from there. English teacher. Well, you went from
English teacher to stripper.
School dropout to avid academic at university, after with a bypass through Sadler, to English teacher, to stripping.
Yeah.
How did you...
when you say it like that.
Well, no, I mean, this is probably, we probably agree on this point, but for me, the idea of stripping itself is not a negative. It's certain cultures and ideas that surround stripping. I have perceptions and attitudes that I have the issue with. Not
But I mean, there was a thread for sure.
Yeah,
and I think I'd always been a very strident feminist in my teens and 20s, and I sort of lost my way with it a little bit, I think. But then, I had to put this without sounding a bit like a bit of a wanker, but I think, you know, I did quite a lot of meditation and yoga and a lot of connecting with myself as a woman, because a lot of the sort of second wave feminism rejected a lot of what they perceived as being traditionally feminine. Mm. So, you know, makeup, doing your hair, wearing sexy underpants, that kind of stuff. And that notion of being objectified by men, or simply being an object for male appreciation, I think had undermined a lot of women's connection to their sacred, true feminine identity. And I can't say that without sounding wanky, I'm sorry. and so for me, that took the form of I was in a very abusive relationship. I wasn't physically abusive, just emotionally abusive. That's while I was teaching. That left me considerably overweight and convinced of my utter hideousness. This man just destroyed my confidence and who I was as a person. I believed I was... I didn't think anyone could ever possibly find me attractive or ever possibly want to be with me because I was so disgusting. And when we finally split up and I got away from him, I spent a lot of time doing yoga, meditation, and just getting my figure back, really. I mean, I started going to the gym and started looking after myself, trying to eat well, and I started pole dancing just to do something different in the kind of gym activity.
And I can see why that would also appeal if you've had your confidence really not
that's
going
kind of
to
I
something
it.
that seems so out there and so openly sexy would just be very
and
attractive.
It was at the time, because you know, nowadays you've got people calling for it to be in the Olympics, but when I started, most of the classes took place in strip clubs and were run by strippers who were just starting to bring it out of the strip clubs as some kind of fitness.
Because so, in the circus there is Chinese pole, which is a discipline.
Yes.
I mean, the moves are quite different in many ways, but there is some crossover.
Yes.
But circus skills didn't really seem to be a real thing until very recently.
No. I'm not entirely sure that's true, because I think there were always girls in the clubs. Mm. You know, I was seeing... When the first competition started happening, which was probably a couple of years into my pole dancing career, I was seeing a higher level of pole dancing in strip clubs, because I used to go to a lot of strip clubs because it was the only place you could watch pole dancers. I was seeing a higher level of trick in the strip clubs than I was seeing in the competitions, and that slowly kind of changed. So I think there were always girls who worked at it, and I think there's always been a very strong and silent crossover between dance and gymnastics and stripping.
Mm.
That's why a lot of girls are really flexible, because, you know, they've got a lot of dance training behind them. So yeah, I went into it very much about, I wanted to remember what it felt like to feel like a woman and to feel sexy, to connect with that part of myself. And I absolutely wasn't alone in that. I saw that. Mm. I became addicted to it very quickly, because it was physically very demanding. But of course, what goes with that when you work it is a massive sense of achievement when you manage to go upside down for the first time, or climb the pole for the first time, or I don't know, whatever it is you do. And then I started teaching it, and what I saw in the women that I was teaching was women who had no idea how to be sexy or how to embody and express that part of themselves. So they'd come into the class on week one, and most of them wouldn't want to take their leggings off. You know, and by week six they'd be wiggling their asses in tiny little hot pants, and that was a beautiful thing to see, you know, because you were really connecting people with a part of themselves that they had lost any sense of having a relationship with.
Mm.
And I found that massively inspiring.
Well,
I think you cannot deny, you know, if you're hanging by one arm at 10 metres that you have to trust yourself and you have to have self-belief.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, enormously empowering. But I don't think you, and there are a lot of people that want to do this, want to divorce off the sexy side of pole, and you can't. You know, people want, like you say, they can go to circus classes, they can go to gymnastics, but people come to pole dancing classes because they want to feel sexy, whether they are prepared to admit that or not. And in recent years, I've been very vocal about my irritation and rage and disgust at a lot of the pole sport crew who want to deny that side of pole dancing. Makes me furious.
Just make it purely athletic.
It's not.
Well, it's part of the sort of puritanical desire to segregate sexuality.
Yeah, exactly.
It's part of a culture that is other and therefore negative,
yeah.
Whereas we're humans, we're made to have sex.
Yeah.
Like, we're made to reproduce. Yeah. So why deny the fact that it's... Because I feel like there's two sides of that, because on the one hand, our idea of what is sexy has been so warped by years of the male gaze, patriarchy, etc., etc. But then on the other hand, sexuality and women feeling attractive and sexy, you have to. It's an inherent part of how we express ourselves as humans. So it's a tricky, it's a really thorny thing where people want to divorce certain things from the sexuality side of it. And it's
But I think the first step towards that is not negating that aspect of pole dancing, pole dancing's history. You know, if you're effectively sanitising it and becoming, you know, kind of middle class apologists for its roots, you're doing it a disservice, and you're doing all women a disservice.
Mm.
And in terms of that sexual energy, I mean, to my mind, that energy is sacred. And I'm going to sound like a new age twat here. I don't care, but you know,
sorry, we can go all hippie woo woo. That's cool. I'm hippie positive.
Yeah, female sexual energy. I think as women, we have a duty to embrace it, because it's the essence of who we are. It is that sexual energy is the ultimate creative energy. It's the energy that creates life. I'm quite comfortable with the term goddess energy. You know, that's our goddess energy. And I feel that we need to connect with that. And part of the tragedy of patriarchy is that it's cut us off from that. And actually, second wave feminism assisted that process, because it first of all, that was aligned and made, you know, the bitch men effectively,
right.
You know, it was theirs just to serve men.
Any expression of that was actually playing into
exactly
patriarchal
and
views of women.
Feminism
sexuality.
Stepped away from that and said,
yeah.
No, you can't own that, because that basically makes you a boy toy. And I think true feminism is, you know, we embrace that in the way that, you know, Boudicca and our ancient sisters did, the witches who were burned at the stakes, and, you know, those women were in possession of their true feminine. And it makes me want to put my hands on my belly, because, you know, that's where it's at. And it's really interesting how, you know, in a class, and I've noticed this when I've taught burlesque as well, just how many women really struggle to get into their hips. And you've probably noticed this as a belly dancer, because,
yeah.
You know, you can really see that in belly dancing. I mean, that energy is really powerful, really powerful.
And people are drawn to it because of that. You get
exactly.
A very high proportion of people who want
yes.
to connect with that.
Yes, because that's our truth. That's who we are as women. I think it's really interesting. My journey into burlesque was not a smooth one, in the sense that when I first became aware of it and went to a lot of shows, I certainly enjoyed it and found it entertaining. But I thought it was inherently dishonest.
That's an interesting word.
Yeah. Well, I kind of felt, and I talk about this in my show actually, I kind of felt that it presents a mediated and slightly sanitised theatrical vision of female sexuality.
Mm.
Whereas if you go into a strip club, what you experience is female sexuality. You know,
really?
In the strip, if I work, because I'd done traditional strip work, coming into burlesque, you know, it was theatrical. It was over the top. It wasn't real. And when I was performing it, energetically, it felt different. It was coming from a different space in myself. So there was more of a self-consciousness about it. Whereas, you know, when you're on the pole and you kind of lose yourself. And I don't know if you get this when you belly dance, but there is a sense where the performance kind of takes you over, and it becomes you're not thinking about what move you're doing next. You're just moving, and there's a lot of, you know, touching yourself fairly inappropriately. So yeah, from my experience, I was kind of looking at burlesque and thinking, because I've always felt that there's something very classist about burlesque, it is very middle class, and there are a lot of performers who sort of make a point of displaying their educational credentials and saying, you know, I'm not an idiot, I'm intelligent, and I'm an artist, and I'm not a stripper.
Because you said when you were in a strip club, you felt that was a very raw expression of female sexuality, which is completely different to how most people would view strip clubs.
Yeah.
So did you start on pole and then actually started performing from taking pole classes? And that's how you made the transition to club work?
So I was training on the pole, and I learned to pole dance. I didn't learn to do pole fitness.
Yeah.
So I am incapable of doing basic spin without patting my ass. It just doesn't happen. I started getting... the pole dancing school that I was working for would have people ring up and want to book pole dancers. So I mainly did private work. I only did a little bit of club work. But I did strip work as well as pole dancing as well. So... And full nude stripping as well, you know. But it was kind of, I can't remember what they were called. It was the Lions Club or some kind of, a bit like the Rotary Club, but a bit smuttier, I think. And I did quite a lot of their events, so they'd sort of have boxing events and things. So you'd be the ring girl and you'd have to walk around with the number between the rounds, and then at the end you took all your clothes off and that was a good evening's entertainment, so whatever. But you know what, as far as I was concerned, you know, it was a nice amount of cash money in my pocket and not much effort. And your question was around
perceptions of strip clubs. So there's the traditional idea that strip clubs are the dominion of male sexuality, but when your experience was different,
ultimately who controls that situation in a strip club? The women control it. They part of the fantasy is that the men control it. But, you know, most of the girls who work, it's the thing, you know, it's very nice to have a view of them all as exploited and not having any other choice and, you know, whatever else you want to say about them. But certainly my experience was generally these were articulate, strong, fairly literate and articulate people who, you know, sort of understood what they were going into. And there's been a lot written about it, and I think it's really easy to say that most people fall into it, or they're exploited by it or whatever. And I think, you know, as with any profession, there's good and bad experiences. But certainly when you're a woman in a strip club and you're watching other women in a strip club and the men are sort of there larging it up and whatever, the person in control of that situation is the stripper. It's not the men. You know, she dictates what happens in that space, and part of that fantasy is that men are men. And it never fails to amaze me how many men I've spoken to, and you'd say, oh, I'm a pole dancer, or, you know, I used to go to a lot of strip clubs or whatever, and they go, oh yeah, oh, I knew this stripper once, oh, we were really good friends, you know, we'd just chat, and I'd be like, yeah, she's working. No, we got on really well. I'm like, she's working.
She's a player.
She's working.
She's playing her game,
And I almost started to feel sorry for men, that they were so willing to believe in the fantasy, to believe that this fantastically beautiful, sexy woman was massively interested in them and simply there for their pleasure. And I still find that quite bizarre. I don't know how to explain it. Maybe it is like when you were saying about belly dancing. You know, when that energy overtakes you, when that energy is expressed, and we see that all the time in strip clubs when girls are on the pole. Yes, certainly you see some who are dead behind the eyes, who are just going through the motions, and you see some who are coked up to fuck. But a lot of the time, you see girls who are really in their power. Really happy.
Yeah.
Doing what they're doing. We criticise women who are sexy, who are comfortable with their sexuality, whose sexuality doesn't conform to the idea of them being chaste or prim or whatever, and we ostracise them to an extent. And so we effectively say that the industries that they then go and work in, where they have the opportunity to express that part of themselves, are somehow poor choices, you know, and those industries in themselves are inherently bad and corrupting and what have you. Whereas it's our broader culture that has created the situation that means we have to marginalise the expression of that energy.
And therefore, because it's marginalised, it does become what it conforms to our ideas.
Yeah.
Because of the marginalisation, not because of the fact that it's to do with sex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, going back to burlesque, I have seen it change in the time. I mean, I started performing in 2008, and I was interested in it and going to shows for a number of years before then. And I have seen it change, definitely. And I think in some senses, you know, it's become slicker, it's become more, you know, the production values are higher. But in a sense, it's also become quite sanitised now from what it was. Not all of it, of course. But I think there's less diversity, actually, now.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. This is a little mini plug for something you do. Actually, it might be interesting to get you on board if you're around. On the 11th of October, I'm doing a live version of the podcast at the Cabaret Convention, and the topic that, after much discussion, I've chosen is cabaret, the physical act, and how we approach... Basically, it's all about physicality and performance and how we approach people who fall outside of what we perceive as the norm and how we approach gender in performance. So we're going to talk about drag, we're going to talk about trans performers, we're going to talk about people who fall outside the mainstream, because I think you're right in that we've seen recently, well, I've seen in main, you know, I mean, I frequent all the nights that I can afford to go to. And in the smaller places, you see a lot of diversity, I find. But in the mainstream, I'm beginning to see the cookie cutter mold of beautiful, classic, tiny waisted, corseted lady doing very beautiful, classic fan dance.
And I think part of that comes from, you know, burlesque had a little bit of a, well, it had a slow burn, you know, it kind of grew slowly and then suddenly it went poof, you know, and in the aftermath of that, everyone stopped putting on burlesque nights and they started putting on cabaret nights, and they'd have, you know, several variety or cabaret acts and probably a burlesque act, and burlesque was represented by a notion of it as being a sort of classic striptease, whereas in a dedicated night of burlesque, you'd still want variety in your build, so you might have some classic showgirl stuff, but then you'd also have, you know, comedy, you might have someone who's, I don't know, doing something that's a little bit more dark and serious, but there'd certainly be a sense of diversity in there, whereas, like you say, there's almost like, if I want burlesque in my show, this is what it looks like now.
Yeah.
And it's one act, and comedy's represented by either a stand-up or a character comedian or a funny juggler or whatever, you know, so that's how you get your laughs. It's not so much doing what I do. So.
Yeah. Well, what you do is fantastic. I love it. I love things that are quirky and different and well thought out. That's my favourite.
I try.
So you felt that your entry into burlesque was complicated for the very reason that you'd had this experience stripping in a very different context.
Yeah, and I think, although when I started, a lot of the burlesque artists had club backgrounds, you know, they worked as strippers, a lot of them tend to be quite quiet about that these days.
Interesting.
Yeah, but yeah, I think because I'd sort of seen it as very much a theatrical endeavour, to my mind, I wanted to pole dance in an environment that didn't necessarily mean sticking my vagina in men's faces. And so burlesque seemed to me a really good opportunity for that, because I could bring to it my other skill set of, you know, kind of theatre and actor training to create something that at the time was quite similar to a lot of what, not similar to what else was going around, but there were a lot of kind of narrative comedic burlesque performers around, and so that was what I was doing.
How long were you performing burlesque? How have you been performing burlesque?
So 2008 was when I started.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what's that, six years?
Yeah.
I think it was October 2008 as well, so I couldn't tell you the date.
It's about when I started belly dance.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, it was a good year for
Good year, yeah. Good year to start getting into some performance that allows you to access interesting parts of yourself.
Yeah, and I think at the time I was kind of the only person doing it, and I'm sure somebody will react to that, because there were other people that were saying that they were doing burlesque on a pole, but what that kind of meant was usually wearing a basque and doing pole act, with a fascinator on or whatever. and I was very clear about the fact that my acts were burlesque first and foremost, in the sense that they were comedic character-based theatrical narratives with striptease that employed a pole as a theatrical device.
Yeah.
And I was very clear about that.
Interesting. What was the response to it?
Good on the whole. It's really cool pole dancing in front of a lay audience, an audience who doesn't know what pole dancing looks like, because you can do something quite simple and everyone's like, oh my god, how is that even possible?
It was exactly the same because no one knows what it's supposed to look like.
Exactly. So it was really nice. So the audience really liked it. And of course, because it was very different to a lot of what other people were doing, it added another dimension to the show. So it was very popular in that respect. I did have quite a few burlesque purists at the time tell me that what I did was not burlesque, that pole dancing was, you know, what strippers did, and it had no place in burlesque, which made me laugh like a drain, really, because, you know, what they considered to be burlesque is what was happening in strip clubs 50 years ago, so they could all go and fuck themselves, as far as I was concerned.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Did you find, with your sort of social group, like friends and family, when you made the jump from teacher to stripper and burlesque performer, pole performer and teacher, did you find any backlash from that?
No, not at all.
You've got good friends then.
Yeah, but you know, I'm very, you know, my sense of identity is very strong, a very close sense of who I am and what I stand for. And I think because, you know, I'm articulate, I'm intelligent and I have integrity, if I say I'm pole dancing or I'm being a stripper, people wouldn't think, oh my god, she's had a mental breakdown. They'd think, well, certainly my friends were, okay, there must be, you clearly know what you're doing, you know, it's obvious that you're not just doing this out of desperation, you've clearly made a choice. And I think because I was very clear about why I was doing what I was doing, what that meant to me, everyone was very supportive of it, and I've never apologised for it, and I've never denied it. In fact, I put it on my CV, so I still work in advertising freelance, and it's on my CV. All of the skills that I have and the work that I've done, I've got a separate performance CV, but it kind of says, you know, from 2008 I have been doing this, you know, because I always figured that the chances of a client or someone turning up to a show were probably fairly high, and I didn't think there was anything shameful in what I did. And actually, if I hid what I did, I implied that there was something shameful about it. So I was very open about it all. And no doubt, you know, people sniggered about it behind my back, or, you know, made comments about it in the cafeteria or whatever. As far as I was concerned, this is what I did.
Oh, everyone's going to make comments about something.
Yeah, well, everyone has an opinion.
Yeah, everyone's going to have an idea about an opinion about what people do.
Yeah, but it goes back to what we were saying about pole dancing, you know, that the pole sport lot have to sort of apologise for the sexiness of pole and move away from it and say, oh, but yes, but I'm not like that. And as far as I was concerned, I never apologised for it. This is what I do, and you can rationalise that how you like, but I am proud of what I do. I think what I can do with my body is amazing, and I have enormous respect for the women that do this professionally. So why would I be ashamed about that? Why would I hide that? Mm. You know, if I was going to trampolining classes, I wouldn't hide it.
So. Well, you also mentioned that you have trapeze experience.
Yeah.
When did that come in?
Probably a couple of years into my pole training. I went off to Bristol with a friend of mine and did a week-long intensive circus course that nearly killed me.
Oh, was that with Circumedia?
No, it was with Circus Maniacs.
Yeah.
Circus Maniacs? Yes. Yeah, that was pretty intense. And I think, like a lot of pole dancers, I initially sort of fell in love with aerial hoop. And I think our fascination with that comes from the fact that, you know, pole is a rigid piece of equipment and so is a hoop. So we're sort of used to the dynamic of the body moving around the apparatus.
Being flexible around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I came back to London and was trying to find classes, but there were none, because it was before the whole circus thing really sort of exploded. So I was able to find static trapeze classes, and my teacher said to me, well, you have to realise that actually static trapeze is the classical music of the circus arts. And once you've mastered that, then you can do anything else. And that convinced me. So I signed up for static classes and completely fell in love with trapeze.
Brilliant. Mm. Brilliant. I say that because I just took a trapeze class yesterday.
Did you?
The backs of my knees are
absolutely
killing me.
Yeah.
But it's great. I love it.
Well, it combines both of those things because you've got a rigid bar and then you've got the ropes.
Yeah.
And I love the versatility of it. And I always said, you know, there's nowhere in the world that I feel more beautiful than sitting on a trapeze. And because I'm not really, I wouldn't say I'm a massively elegant burlesque performer. Most of my characters are quite grotesque in one way or another. But trapeze just makes me want to have beautiful long lines and be terribly elegant.
It's one of the oldest disciplines as well, which I like the history behind it because I do silks. Silks is my aerial experience. And that's relatively modern, the last 20 years or so. Mm. But looking at trapeze, I kind of went, And I love the history behind it. And I found a film that Thomas Edison took, the trapeze performer, in 1901, doing a striptease.
Yes, I've seen
on
that.
The
I've seen that.
It's wonderful.
It is wonderful. But when you look at some of the Victorian pictures of trapeze artists, and women doing them in full dresses and what have you, it is slightly insane. But no, I mean, I did quite a lot of aerial training out in Vegas as well. Did quite a lot of silks out
there. When did you go to Vegas?
Lots of times, actually, between about 2005 and 2010, or sort of out there most years for a few weeks training. And it's really, because obviously you've got all the big circ shows at the casino, so there's loads of aerialists out there and loads of training spaces. Maybe. So I did a bit of pole training out there and a lot of silks. Yeah.
It's good fun.
Yeah. Those silks make your forearms absolutely kill. That's what I found really hard on
I
it.
Find part, one of the things I'm liking about trapeze is you can sit and rest.
Yeah.
You can sit on the trapeze and still look beautiful and rest, whereas silks you have to make
a footlock.
A footlock or a hip lock.
Yeah.
Or an upside down like a cactus or something.
Yeah.
And no matter what you do, your resting point is still going to hurt a part of your body. So you're going to be hanging there like, I am resting, but I need to move soon because it really does hurt.
Yeah, and I can't feel my foot.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's what I like. I like the versatility of the trapeze, that there are these different dimensions to it. And you know, you can do stuff up in the ropes, you can do stuff around the ropes, you've got above the bar, you've got below the bar, you can do stuff on one rope, on two ropes, you know, lots of double stuff you can do on it.
It's a very exciting piece of equipment.
Yeah, I really miss it. I really miss it.
So I was going to ask, what's been the development of your performance?
Yeah.
I know there's...
So, 15th of October 2011, I walked across a stage in London that shall remain nameless for the time being. And because somebody had very thoughtfully spilled candle wax all over it, I slipped and fell on my left shoulder. Quite heavily. Got up, popped my blindfold, did 5.5 minutes of blindfolded acrobatic pole dance, came off stage and thought, I really need to go to hospital. So, yeah. I dislocated my collarbone, several vertebrae, ribs, and the force of the impact just meant that I had a massive amount of scar tissue in my shoulder joint. So I then got what's called a frozen shoulder, where the whole joint just kind of goes into shock.
Just locks that
because it's so traumatised. And usually a frozen shoulder lasts 2.5 to 3 years. And I think I managed to get through mine in about 2 years, but I had a lot of therapy on it to try and move it. And I still don't have a complete range of movement. I've still got residual scar tissue in there. So yeah, it could, for the first 8 months, I couldn't move my arm more than a few inches away from my body, so I couldn't dress myself, I couldn't eat with that arm, I couldn't do anything. It was horrific.
So horrendous. Mm. Poor thing. And shoulders are one of the most vulnerable parts of your body. It's only attached by such a small amount of muscle and tissue. Mm. And it's amazing because they have great range of motion, but they're so easy to damage.
Well, this is the thing, and of course the irony is, and you'll know this as an aerialist, you spend all of your time doing a lot of conditioning to protect your shoulders, to make sure that you make the most of, like you say, those ligaments and muscles that surround it and protect it. And there's that whole kind of aerialist folklore that you need to avoid surgery at all costs, because if you have surgery on your shoulders, you're very unlikely to ever really regain your full range of movement. And I didn't have surgery on it. I had an orthopaedic surgeon who wanted to operate and go in arthroscopically and manually scrape out all of the scar tissue, which struck me as being really counterintuitive. So you've damaged your body and it's created scar tissue to protect itself. So you're going to go out and scrape it all out, and all the body's then going to do is go, oh shit, now I need to make more scar tissue, you know. So I didn't have the surgery, and I had a lot of osteopathy on it instead. And all credit to the guy I saw. I mean, I've got, if I were a normal person doing a normal job, then I've got a full range of movement, but I can't hang out of that arm anymore. So,
have you been able to get back into doing things and just modify?
Well, I mean, I had a bit of an issue with my right shoulder anyway. I had an impingement in there, so I was already working around my right shoulder by favouring my left shoulder.
Oh no.
And I think the problem is I've just lost so much flexibility within it. It makes a lot of things very, very difficult. And I guess there's a massive amount of sadness for me. Massive amount of sadness. So I had a huge grieving process, and it really undermined my sense of who I was. It was a massive challenge to my identity as a performer as well as a person. And I've got back on the pole, but I suppose, you know, you get older, you get stiffer, it's hard work, and I just still feel really, really sad about it. I just kind of feel like I lost something at that point. And I think maybe what I lost was not the sense that I was invincible, but the sense that I could do it, that I was strong and disciplined and committed, and despite all of that, yeah, I got fucked up.
It's so tough because, you know, being strong and disciplined and committed has nothing to do with whether you've had an accident or not, but when you're unable to do the thing that makes you feel that way, it's tough to regain that or remember that those things are inherent qualities in you, not the things that you're doing.
Well, it's also how you identify yourself. You know, we were talking earlier about the whole Facebook performance name things.
Yes.
You know, and your sense of who you are and what you are shapes, I believe, your behaviour. And I went from being someone who felt really strong, physically strong, and kind of felt like I could get myself out of trouble. Do you know what I mean? Like I could handle myself, to feeling incredibly vulnerable. You know, there was a point, because I had gigs booked, and I couldn't really afford to lose the money, and I was having to go over to the side of the stage to get a stagehand to unhook my bra and things, to get my bra off in a burlesque act, because I physically couldn't do it myself, you know.
Oh my goodness. Wow. That's a...
Yeah.
It is incredibly tough to hear about physical performers being injured. And with circus, and I would imagine pole, it happens very frequently because they are, you know, you push yourself to the limit. It's dangerous. There's no getting around it. An aerialist, you can fall anytime. No matter how experienced you are, you can fall and you can really damage yourself. Pole, I'm sure, is the same. And that's it for quite a long time. But is there, I mean, have you found ways of kind of beginning to regain that? Have you found a way of working around it?
I think the whole thing shifted for me. And what was tough was that when I'd started performing, I'd built my persona and my kind of brand on being a performer who mixed physical skill, so pole and aerial, with comedic burlesque. And that was what I did, you know, that was my brand. So to then not be able to do the physical stuff, I just went through a huge thing of, well, what am I? Well, basically I'm a stripper who can't even take her clothes off at the moment, you know. So I lost an enormous amount of confidence in myself as a performer. And obviously a lot of the work that I had been getting, I couldn't do anymore. So that was interesting. And it forced me to then think about, well, who am I as a performer? What do I want to be as a performer? What do I stand for as a performer? And I still don't know the answer to that question.
Did you feel like you had a very strong sense of that before?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Because I feel like I'll be constantly questioning that.
Right. And I think a lot of people do, but you know, I think because I was so clear when I started, this is who I am, this is what I do, and this is why I do it like this, for that to be wiped out, and get, you know, I absolutely take on board what you're saying about injury, but in my case, that happened through no fault of my own.
Of course, we were talking about this, how that almost adds another layer of resentment.
It was someone else's negligence that did that, you know, and I still feel very upset about that, not least because of the way the owner of that venue behaved towards me.
Really?
After the accident, yeah. I'm not gonna name names, but yeah, it was very tough.
That's, to my mind, that is actually probably the worst way of, the worst type of injury story, because you know, you were doing your job, you did absolutely nothing wrong, you can't even say, I missed my trick, somebody else.
I walked across the stage.
Yeah.
That's all I did.
And you still managed to do the rest of your act, which, when you get injured, your body obviously kind of goes, and especially when you're on stage, your body automatically goes into self-preservation, so you don't automatically realise what's quite the extent of damage. Mm. So...
No, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't really drive home. I couldn't use this arm, so...
Has there been anything that's come out of it for you that's been illuminating and positive?
Yeah.
Out of all the shit, what's been the good stuff?
Well, you know, the naked stand-up came out of that.
Yeah.
That's a whole line, you know. I had to say to myself, okay, well, if you can't hang upside down and show people your box, what can you do? Well, you know, you can make people laugh. Okay, how do you make people laugh? And at the time... I was doing that very physically through my body, my facial expression, gesture, that kind of stuff. And so initially I kind of worked on that and developed that. Then I started working with my very dear friend, Missy Maybe. We ran a show together. And she, I think, I will go out on a limb and say she's the first person to do this, but, you know, she does burlesque with monologues, character monologues, and the striptease is within the context of the character monologue. So we built this show together and I started doing a similar thing, and that's how I sort of developed a lot of the character comedy work that I then started to do, and started doing a bit more hosting, and all of that then sort of led into doing stand-up.
What, because you said, it was before actually I turned on the microphone, you were talking about having opinions and being
gobby, yeah.
Which I like, gobby people. Obviously, I'm running a podcast. I like people talking. I like people who can talk about interesting things. Mm. Did you find hosting came easily?
Yeah, very easily.
I guess experience as a teacher as
well. Yeah, exactly.
If anyone can control a room as a teacher, or should be able to.
Yeah, you need to do it in a way that they're not all terrified of you, obviously. It's slightly different from teaching, but no. That came very, very naturally. And I think as well, one of the amazing things you do as a teacher is, you know, you have a room full of 30 completely unpredictable teenagers. And so you're making decisions constantly. You're constantly reacting to what's going on in the room and having to be aware of what's going on in the room and feed off what's going on in the room and channel what's going on in the room. And I think when you host, you're doing the same thing, you know. And I started off mainly hosting pole dancing competitions, and I still do a fair bit of that. And obviously they liked me because I was a pole dancer, so I sort of knew what was going on, you know, and could comment on that. But they're quite tough gigs because they go on a long time. I think the longest one was 9 hours.
Oh my!
Yeah,
hosting for 9 hours.
Yeah, that was a job.
Wow.
So we got
a marathon.
Yeah, very much so.
Hosting marathon.
But of course, most of the people that go to support one person or, you know, a few people. So your job is to try and get them behind everyone who's up there. So in that sense, it's quite challenging, you know, because they just want to watch their mates and then fuck off. You know?
And also, I guess, provide a draw for...
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, I'm not supporting that other pole dancer, but the host is so engaging that I want to stick around and see what happens in between and then...
Yeah, and it was really nice, and, you know, I've got a bit of a... I hate the word, but, you know, I've got a bit of a following in that industry, and people think I'm funny, so that's nice to keep booking me, which is always good. Yeah.
It's because you are funny.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Critics seem to think so. Woohoo. It came very naturally, and it was really pleasurable to do it, and I think that notion of connecting with an audience and creating an atmosphere in the room, because that was one of the things that I noticed, was after I'd hosted a competition, people would be writing on Facebook, oh, the atmosphere was amazing, it was so warm, it was so friendly, yada yada yada, and I started to think, I think that might be me doing that, you know, and that's a really powerful skill.
So obviously not all listeners will know.
No.
So I would love
very
to,
few, I'm sure.
I don't know about that. You've made some waves.
Have I?
Oh yes. Well, I think so.
I've been a fat ass.
Absolutely not. No, it's your
naked fat ass.
You said the whole idea for your show, The Naked Stand Up, which did go to Edinburgh this year, came out of the sort of, well, I don't have this part of the identity anymore.
Yeah.
So what am I good at? How did that develop?
Okay, so on a very practical level, I couldn't do aerial work. I was hosting my own show with Missy Maybe, and hosting pole dancing competitions and making audiences laugh, and not in a scripted way. I wasn't writing anything. I was just going out there and people were falling out laughing. And I sort of had the thought, which was the thought I'd had when I was a teenager, of, I'd quite like to try stand-up comedy. That had come back, you know, and that had always been something that I'd been interested in trying. And I think I was hoovering, and I sort of had this idea, because I was thinking, well, okay, if I'm a stand-up, if I do stand-up, what kind of stand-up do I want to be? What would I wear as stand-up? What would my persona be? Because most of them just seem to wear jeans and a t-shirt. I don't own a pair of jeans. So would I just be that kind of stand-up? And I thought, no, the trouble is, because obviously I'm a very strong, true, heartfelt feminist, and I'd want to talk about that, and I think female comedians who talk about feminism tend to be given quite a hard time.
They are pigeonholed in a very unfair way.
Indeed. So I thought, well, I don't really want that. Okay, so then I thought, well, would I wear something burlesque-y? You know, would I be my burlesque persona? And I thought, that doesn't really feel right. Would I wear just a glam dress like I do when I'm hosting? No, that doesn't really feel right. And then this little thought popped into my head, which was, well, you know, if you could do it naked, because then people couldn't pigeonhole you. They wouldn't really know where to put you.
They just put you in the pigeonhole of naked.
Naked, yeah. So you could kind of talk about whatever you want. And I thought, oh, that's a really interesting idea. The naked stand-up, I like it. And it tickled me, you know, the idea.
The idea that you had no idea what to wear, so you just wore nothing.
Yeah, yeah. But also, it's quite catchy, that idea. And it would make people think, whoa. And I think because I'd done Naked Girls Reading with Sophia St. Vivian, I'd done a few of those, and I really loved doing that show. And what I'd noticed doing that show was how being naked in front of an audience where you break the fourth wall, and not in a strip club context, really changes the dynamic between you and the audience. It engenders a kind of intimacy that you usually have to work really, really hard to get. So in some ways it was quite a lazy decision, because it meant that I could just skip all of that and people would be like, fuck, I've just got my clothes on. I mean, in terms of the material, that was very much tied up to my personal existential crisis as a performer. In that, you know, having been really fit and really strong, I'd put on a lot of weight and was somebody who was not physically fit anymore, because I'd had sort of 3 years of not being able to do any exercise, and not really knowing whether I had a place in burlesque anymore, kind of feeling that it had been taken over by damasons in Swarovski encrusted corsets, and also sort of being, because maybe it's just my social media, but the groups that seem to be particularly noisy or prominent at the moment. I don't really feel like I fit into any of those groups. I don't really feel like I do classic showgirl stuff. I don't really feel like I do any of that kind of sort of draggy alt kind of stuff. I certainly don't do any of the sort of freak show dark stuff. And the notion of being a comedic character-based comedy performer seems to have died a little bit just recently. So yeah, I've been really struggling to think, well, where in Burlesque do I fit? And feeling slightly aggrieved at some of the ways in which it's gone. And what I mean by that is being backstage in dressing rooms and suddenly the conversation in those dressing rooms being dominated by discussions about plastic surgery. Or,
really?
Yes. Or about diets or exercise regimes or, you know, whatever it was.
Oh my Lord.
And feeling really sad about that. Feeling really sad about that. Because
that
I can,
is sad.
I can remember having discussions, like we, you know, it sounds like, you know, back in 2008, all those years ago. You know, I can remember having discussions about people actually being quite critical of performers who had breast implants, for example. Because burlesque was about real women. Whatever real women means, but anyway, it's interesting because, you know, there was a lot of scoffing around that, you know, when burlesque first started to become popular, there was a lot of discussion around empowerment, people talking about empowerment, and there was a lot of scoffing around empowerment and people saying, oh no, there's nothing inherently empowering about it. But I think actually for a lot of the women that came to watch it, it was quite empowering, because they would say it's to see a woman on stage who doesn't look like a supermodel or a glamour model or a, you know, Hollywood A-lister, happy to be looked at and to expose herself in a very literal way, was empowering for them. It made them feel better about themselves, you know. And I started to feel like, no, there's more I want to say. Talking to an audience is really important to me. Making people laugh is really important to me. And the thing that's really bugging me at the moment is how utterly obsessed we have become by what we look like. Yeah, and as I wrote the show, I mean, the show kind of wrote itself, where it went, and I did work with a director on it, a guy called Luke Dixon, who lives just across the road from here.
And, oh, cool.
He was great and really helped me to shape it, but I think what I realised when I got up to Edinburgh is that it's sort of not stand-up in the traditional sense, which has left me in exactly the same position, kind of thinking, hmm, you know, where's my box?
Yeah.
Where's my box? I'm not even in a traditional stand-up comedy box. And I have to say, the fact that it bankrupted me and was enormously stressful and exhausting, the act of doing the show was a really beautiful experience. And it was made beautiful by my audiences, you know, because I started off the show by saying, this is not a traditional stand-up comedy show, this is a dialogue, we need to talk to each other. And they did talk to me.
Fantastic.
When they got over their initial, fucking hell, she's got no clothes on, they talked to me. And they told me amazing things. So I just kind of developed some of the sections of the show where I was throwing questions out in an almost slightly rhetorical kind of way and made them actual sort of exercises that we did as an audience together. So we did a thing, I bought one of those red juggling rings, which is my ring of shame.
Yeah.
So we did a thing where you identify a part of your body, all the audience had to form a ring of shame and put it over a part of their body that they didn't like, and then I'd go around and ask everyone what they didn't like and why they didn't like it, and you'd be amazed at the things people told me. It was extraordinary. I mean, we had everything.
Wow.
Toes, bums, balls, penises, noses, ears, ear hair, nipples, boobs, tummies, lots of tummies, yeah. The whole lot. People would just tell me the most amazing and intimate things. And then we did a thing about, you know, what we liked about ourselves. And then at the end of the show, we do a thing about something we like about ourselves that's actually nothing to do with our physical appearance, so some quality or attribute. So, and they were amazing, you know, people who work with handicapped children, people who paint, people who write music, people who travel, people who are adventurous, people who are forgiving, you know, all of these amazing qualities that came out night after night after night, which was a really inspiring thing for me to hear as well. And one of the things that was so just so fantastic. At some point in the run, the audience started talking to each other, and that was fantastic. So someone might say, I really hate my nose. It's got this massive bump in the middle of it. And a woman over the other side of the room would say, oh, I was just looking at your profile, and I think you're really beautiful.
Aww.
How lovely is that? And there's a guy, someone said, oh, I don't like the fact I'm bald, I've not got any hair. And this other bald guy in the audience shouted out, but you've got a really beautiful shaped head. And then of course everyone laughs. And that was just really nice. Like complete strangers being just genuine and kind and lovely to each other. But I think, you know, what I ultimately wanted people to take away was that really what you look like doesn't fucking matter. You know, obviously, I'm not saying that we should all just sit on the couch and eat biscuits, because I think there is something about looking after yourself, but the investment that we put into looking a certain way, in terms of time and energy and money, if we put a tenth of that into how we feel, the world would be transformed, you know. Even the whole, because I'm worth it, because I'm, you know, we're all beautiful, I even find that discourse really irritating.
It's boring.
Well, I just kind of think we're not all beautiful on the outside. We're not. And, you know, if you look back historically, beauty was seen as a very rare commodity and it's valued accordingly. The only reason it becomes something that we all feel we want a part of is if it's presented as being the most important quality to have.
Yeah.
And it's not.
So the thing is, we're not all beautiful, but that should really matter.
But that doesn't matter, because we are clever and articulate and musical and artistic and hardworking and all of these other things that actually makes society a good place to be. You know, I don't think Einstein spent a lot of time worrying about the shape of his eyebrows, you know. I don't think Michelangelo really cared about how straight his nose was. I think there are more important things for us to worry about. I
can't really imagine Beethoven down the pub going, oh, you know, I would write that symphony, but just this double chin is really stressing me out.
Exactly. Right, you know, I would have finished it, but I had to go down the gym and, you know, do my squats.
Yeah,
and I don't know, who do I blame? Capitalism? Probably. I don't know, I'm a Marxist at heart, I think.
Yeah.
But it's depressing.
Yeah. But at the same time, I'm beginning to feel, like you said, this growing frustration, sort of groundswell of pushback against this. You know, it's gone on long enough, and I think there are enough people out there beginning to be vocal.
I hope so.
Which is also helped by things like, you know, the access we have in the information age to connection with other people who agree. And being able to spread, because I was going to ask you related to this, how have you found the wider sort of media response to your show?
It's interesting, because I got a lot of media. Obviously the whole teacher becomes naked stand-up story was fascinating for
it's
Daily Mail.
Titillating.
I was in a very fortunate position of getting quite a lot of national press coverage before I went up to Edinburgh. So I had a story on the Mail Online, and
it's so funny how these newspapers are like, person gets naked, it's a story.
Yeah, teacher gets naked, yeah. So I had an article in the Mail Online, then the Scottish edition of the Mail on Sunday ran a big article. The Scottish edition of the Times ran something. There was quite a lot of my local press down in Kent. Quite a few radio stations, because it was syndicated. So Radio Kent and Sussex interviewed me, and then it's syndicated. I don't quite know how it works anyway. So I sort of had quite a lot of media attention. What's been fascinating about that is that, without exception, that media coverage has been entirely positive, respectful, and positive. Entirely, like even the Daily Mail.
I read the Mail article because I knew you were doing it, obviously, from knowing you prior to this, and seeing the idea and just going, that's bloody brilliant, I'm going to keep my eye on this, even though I'm not up in Edinburgh this year. And seeing you having an article in the Mail, and I went, ooh.
Yeah.
Okay, let's open this up, see what's happened. And I read it, and I went, this is really brilliant.
Yeah.
This, you know, this is actually a really,
really nice article.
Respectful article. There's no gross, leery tone to it.
No, comments were interesting, but you know.
I started and then I went, you know what? Yeah. I'm the rule of the internet. Do not read the comments.
No,
it's not worth it.
And I spent quite a lot of time thinking about that, and I think because I was so clear about my intentions and my reasons for doing it, I don't think there could be any misinterpretation of that. So I think that really helped. But I also believe that the work came from such a pure place that that energy carries it out into the world.
So what's next, not sure.
I don't know. This is the thing. I sort of feel like I've opened a bit of a floodgate, but I don't really know what to do with it. I feel that the without sounding I don't know, maybe I should stop apologising for sounding wanky. I don't know. I kind of feel like the show is important, that it discusses
that's not wanky at all
important things.
Yeah.
And it's a conversation that needs to be had. The forum for that conversation, I don't know. I'm looking at maybe doing a couple of dates this autumn in London, and I'll probably do Brighton Fringe next year. They've already said they'd like to take the show, so I don't know. But you know, I did a burlesque a couple of weeks ago, and it was a lot of fun. And I thought, oh yeah, this is why I like burlesque. I remember that. Yeah, that was good. But there's more in this, and there's a real depth of connection with the audience in this show that is an honour to be a part of. And you can, I came on stage every night feeling really, sounds so wanky, just grateful and blessed and amazed and amused and touched by the things that had been said in the show by the audience. That's really lovely.
It's one of those things, it's like once you go down that rabbit hole, you go back and you're kind of like, oh,
yeah.
I mean, this is fun, but look at what I found over here.
Yeah, but like, you know, as I was saying earlier, I don't really know which box I fit into. I don't know where, I don't know what's the platform for that. And
well, it is a sort of, it is a first outing, you know, so there's still time for development. Which will probably be quite an enjoyable process, considering how positive it's been so far.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll see. I don't know. Part of me, you know, Edinburgh's so intense.
Oh, God.
And part of me came away from that thinking, oh, you know, I'm sick of living this 24/7. I need to think about something else for a while. But I don't know. I still feel like I'm decompressing from that experience. It was really intense. And also, you know, one of the things that became very clear to me in Edinburgh, and again, I'm going to sound really wanky, so, you know, I'm not a performer. I'm an artist.
Yeah.
And what drives me is not the adulation of an audience. It's the need to express my truth. And I really felt that in Edinburgh. I really felt that. So the whole promotional machine that goes on around the show is absolute anathema to me. And I've always really struggled with that and beaten myself up about it and called myself lazy and, you know, that I've got childhood issues and you know, all of that. I just fucking hate it. I've realised that's not
marketing.
I'm not a promoter.
Yeah.
I can promote other people very well. I worked in advertising for I don't know how long. But in terms of promoting my product, my art, I just really struggle with that.
Probably goes with the Marxism as well.
Yeah, maybe
probably
it does. It
sticks together in a little similar. The whole idea.
Just need a revolution and then I'll be alright.
I don't know, revolutions are a bit messy. Never turns out the way you expect.
No.
It's the way you hope.
Oh, God, yeah.
A little revolution would be bad, though.
End up with Putin.
Oh. That's a whole other podcast.
It is, isn't it?
That's the Rosie Hall-Sproulville political podcast.
Yeah,
I feel like having more artists and entertainers in power wouldn't be too bad. I'd be quite excited if Eddie Izzard ever got to be mayor of London.
You would, but nothing would ever get done, would it? Let's be honest. You need everyone. You need ideas, people, but you need people to make stuff happen too.
Yeah. I don't know if Boris Johnson's a make stuff happen kind of person.
Boris Johnson's a cunt.
I'm keeping that in. I'm keeping that in this podcast. Sorry, Boris, if you're listening, we really, really do not like you at all.
No.
So, oh, I always ask at the end of the podcast, except for the one time that I forgot, I always ask, what has been your best moment on stage and what's been your worst moment on stage?
Oh, gosh.
I know. It's a killer question. It's usually just for some fun anecdotes at the end to leave people with.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a few. The thing is, when you pole dance, you always have to deal with the possibility that the pole is going to fall down. So that's happened a couple of times.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
What about the best? Let's go for the best first.
Yeah, I don't know. And I've had a fire alarm go off in the middle of my act. Someone, it was in Soho actually, someone left their handbag next to a tea light and it caught light and set the fire alarm off. And so the music cut and the lights went out. And they did it just as I revealed my bra. So some of the audience, there's this kind of wave of confusion that went across the audience, with half of them thinking that the fire alarm was just part of the act and half of them thinking they were going to burn to death fairly shortly. So that, yeah, that was fun. I don't know, the first night in Edinburgh, that was pretty grim. I sort of came off stage because I think when you come on stage thinking I didn't do a good job, that's the worst feeling, and I didn't feel like I did a good job. I didn't feel I gave that audience a good show. So I'd say that's one of my worst. My best, I don't know. I've had lots of amazing experiences. You know, getting standing ovation in Paris was the first time I did Ethel there. It was amazing. I remember being in a show in Paris. I love Parisian audiences, and I do this act. She never really gets booked in London, but it's called The Empress of Fate, and it's presented as being a very serious piece of performance art about life, death, the cruelty of fate, all this kind of stuff. And so I do this very dramatic striptease to Carmina Burana with Isis wings, and when my tunic comes off, people start getting flashes of my bum and they start to giggle, and I really ham it up so it feels like it's they're not sure whether to laugh or not myself seriously. And then at the end of the act, the reveal is that I've got two pasties. My pasties are eyes, and my merkin is my C string is lips. So I've got this little silly little face and my body. So then I just do some stupid dancing to I think Spanish Flea by Vampa. Yeah. So it's very silly. Anyway, I did this in Paris, and this guy came up to me. Kind of typical sort of French intelligentsia, so middle-aged guy, graying temples, you know, very elegantly dressed.
Speaking good words.
And he said to me, oh, you know, you're amazing, you're the best thing in the show. And I said, oh, it's very kind of you, thank you so much. I guess because I'm British, I tend to think maybe my sense of humour won't translate. No, you're amazing. I said, oh, thank you. I do tend to think I'm just a bit of a tit now. I just mess about on stage. Mais oui, but that is the human condition. And I just love that. You know, you can just make a complete tit of yourself on stage in France. But they will see some philosophical.
So philosophical. Yeah. So deep.
I love that.
So, now for the final thing, which is, where can people find you out in the world? Lay some links on me. Facebook, Twitter.
Okay, so I've got a website that's out of date, missglorypearl.co.uk. I've got a Twitter account, at Miss Glory Pearl, that I go on to fairly sporadically. I'm quite active on Facebook. The Naked Stand-Up's got a Facebook page, which I post on occasionally.
Search The Naked Stand-Up.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe see me in London. I'm hoping to be part of the Mimetic Festival.
Yes,
I'm trying to sort that out.
That's Alex.
In November, in the vaults.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. Thank you, darling. It's been lovely.
Thank you. And listeners, I have been your host, Rosie Cole. You can find me on the internet as well. You can find me on facebook.com/RosieColeDancer. You can find me on Twitter at Rosie_Cole. You can find my website, RosieCole.com. Or if you have any suggestions, questions, comments, ideas, email me, RosieColeDancer@gmail.com. And as performers, we are nothing without an audience. So thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.